Welcome to A Fork in Time, the alternate history podcast.
Fork in Time. When we say welcome back, we really mean welcome back. I got a cast of we're going to go with characters. That's the word I'm going to use on my screen here. Just as a hint for what we intend to do down the road for our patrons, we intend to have a couple of episodes. We're actually going to start those recordings about 20 minutes before this, so you can hear what actually happens before what just happened happens in the future. But for this one, you're coming in as we get ready to start this episode here. Joining me, I have Alexis, by the way, carrying a new last name since her wedding. So welcome back to this one, your first recording. This is your first recording as a married woman. Is that correct, Alexis?
Yes, it actually is my first recording as a married woman.
All right. Congratulations to Lex and good to have her back. I have.
I just got a thumbs up from my husband, by the way, because he's in the room. Just throwing that out there.
Yeah. We won't be able to entice Jake to get on a recording for history, I'm sure, at any point soon. But he married well when it comes to historical knowledge. I've got show contributor, cartographer, curmudgeon. I got deep cut Chris Coppola. How you doing, Chris?
Hi to the good people.
Hi to the good. See, I didn't even fall into it, and there you go. And we've got one of our newer contributors that we're happy to have, and he's been stepping up in a big way since he's joining the group here at Fork in Time. I got Eric Bond. How are you today, Mr. Bond?
I'm feeling great, Don.
Good, good. So we're going to jump right in here. You might have guessed, if you were going to guess, if you're a longtime listener of the show, Alexis is on an episode. So where do you think we might go?
Alternative outcomes of the Franco-Prussian War.
Of course.
Oh, totally.
That's the logical thing. She is all 19th century Europe all the time.
We're finally going to get into whether or not what would happen if Karl Marx had moved to Texas.
There you go.
Like he wanted to.
Oh, that's a whole other thing. There's actually a room where it happened that we have planned down the road that actually is around a couple of things that we're gonna touch Mr. Marx and Mr. Ingalls here at some point. So hold on to that thought, Eric. We're coming back around to it. We're gonna go to that bejeweled Jolly Isle known as England. At this point, it's not Great Britain yet, so we're really talking about England here. But we're gonna talk about another flavor of a Henry VIII. Offshoot, an alternative here, but I'm going to pass it over to Eric to sort of set the stage for us here. And this one's similar but different. That's what we were just talking about off podcast, is you'll see flavors of things we've talked about before, because this has been a popular time in history and a popular locale for us in history, but not quite this way of going after it. So I think it's going to be the same but different. So Eric, set the stage for us, if you would, with the historical what did.
Well, first, everybody, I'm just so happy to be back. The thing I want to ask you about today is, did you ever go to a really bad party? Like, you were just expecting it to be like, oh, finally, I've accomplished so much. Everything is behind me. I just want to relax with my friends, my family, and celebrate the death of my ex-wife. Well, that was Henry VIII on January 24th of 1536. Catherine of Aragon had passed away 17 days earlier due to heart cancer, something I found out existed today. And he was celebrating the pregnancy of Anne Boleyn, and she was certain it was a boy this time. So spirits are high. Mary, the daughter of Catherine and Henry, who is now delegitimized as a bastard lady in waiting, is not on speaking terms to her father and is not invited to this party. And Henry is going to do the one thing he has always loved since being a teenager. He is going jousting, and he is on the horse and he's going at full speed, and he is off the horse and he has fallen down and he is unconscious. So he is unconscious for 2 hours and 5 minutes, according to the reports of the diplomat from the Holy Roman Empire, Eustace Chapuis. He thankfully wakes up. Thankfully is kind of hard to say for everybody else who knows the story afterwards, but he does wake up. He seems to be okay. But if you've ever watched a true crime documentary, you know this is the part when, after a traumatic head injury, they change. Henry gives up jousting. His wife, Anne Boleyn, unfortunately does miscarry 5 days after the event. It is recorded to have been a boy. Before the year is out, Anne Boleyn will be tried for adultery, treason, and probable incest. The veracity of these claims is very much disputed, but she will be dead before the end of the year, and Henry will have married her lady-in-waiting, Jane Seymour. And, well, we've all seen Six the Musical at this point, so you know what happens next. But today we're going to see what would have happened if Henry just didn't wake up.
So the fork that we're going to take, and Eric did a good job of setting the stage there, the fork that we're going to take is Henry's death. I guess there's other ways you might take this, and I'm just going to mention this because we talked about it a little bit off podcast. There's good reason to believe, again, this is a different Henry when he wakes up. Things are altered. Things are not the same as they had been moving forward. Certainly the miscarriage, the loss of the child, you know, probably has an impact on that as well. But, you know, I was joking about, you know, it's hard. I have a hard time imagining Henry VIII jousting because I have the Ren Faire in Texas. It's the Renaissance Festival. You know, I have the big jolly Henry in my head, and I can't imagine how big the horse would have needed to be for the joust there. But, you know, as a younger man, he was, you know, fit. He enjoyed these types of activities, doing these types of things. I guess it's a little more of the Tudor's version of a Henry versus, you know, the Henry that's popular in Renaissance fair lore. But we're not going to go down that path of what if this had not altered the real life Henry, which is what was one possible path that we could take. We're actually going to do the simpler fork here. The simpler fork is that he just doesn't wake up from the accident. So now there's the question of, in fact, the whole thing about why Anne Boleyn, why it's so important, as you said, that there's a celebration going on that she's pregnant, is the whole issue of who is going to be the heir, particularly a male heir, because at this point there's only the female heir in the form of Mary. So we're going to go down that.
No, there's two female heirs. We got Elizabeth.
We got Elizabeth, mm-hmm. too. Thank you, Alexis. But we don't have.
Granted, we don't have two, but yeah, you know.
We don't have the male. We don't have the male heir that we're looking for here, or that he's.
Well, we do have. We do right. have a male. We have Henry Fitzroy, who is right. the illegitimate son.
And that's where we're going to go here as we start speculating here. So we have Henry dies. So again, as Alexis properly corrected me, Mary is approximately what age here, give or take? She's not yet of age, correct?
Mary is 19.
Okay.
So yeah, technically she is of age.
So one option would be for the, and I'm going to step back here and let the Anglophiles go after this here shortly. One possibility would be Mary assumes the throne. The other possibility is some form of regency for Elizabeth, although that sounds strange given that you've passed over her, other than the difference in mothers, why that would not be necessarily the same, but putting
and
the 2-year-old
Mary had been delegitimized at this point. Elizabeth correct. Hadn't.
So the correct. One possibility would be Elizabeth there. What other possibilities? You just sort of mentioned there one, Eric. What are the options here? You gotta have a king on the throne. Or you got to have somebody on the throne. What are the options here, and how does that play out with the end of Henry?
So as we discussed before, you know, we have Mary, age 19. She is old enough to assume the throne. The problem is she's been delegitimized by Henry and has been declared a bastard. We have a regency under Anne Boleyn, largely for Elizabeth, who is about 2 or 3 years old at this time. The problem there is that everybody's kind of turned on Anne Boleyn at this point. Her relationship with Henry VIII could have best been described as mercurial. Like,
K-U-S
basically,
is another word.
Yeah. Fodder for a Real Housewives type series.
Basically, there's going to be another party when she's executed. This is what I'm hearing.
Exactly. Like, she'll be dead by the end of the year in the actual timeline. And there is also presuming that we don't go with some other relation, say, like Henry's sister up in Scotland at this point, we have Henry Fitzroy. Henry is the bastard son of a lady-in-waiting and King Henry, and he is his only surviving male child that he's ever had. He's been elevated to the Duke of Somerset and Richmond, and there were talks that he was being more and more favored by Henry because he just needed a male heir. And there's
there has been some legitimization of him, some recognition that he is Henry's son. As
he's
I
the
understand,
only child
right, he's acknowledged.
That Henry has actually claimed.
There may be others floating around out there.
Right. That's why he has the last name Fitzroy. It literally means son of the king.
Absolutely. And he had been getting closer with Henry. It was said that they would talk every day and that Anne Boleyn was looking for ways to get rid of Henry Fitzroy. Now, during the negotiations with the Pope in Rome, the Pope had floated the idea that instead of you dissolving your marriage to Catherine of Aragon, I will legitimize Henry Fitzroy, and then we can do a papal dispensation to have him marry Queen Mary I, which is why you will see the episode titled Wed Like an Egyptian, because I was really listening to the Bee Gees while reading my copy of Wolf Hall. So...
The Bee Gees or the Bengals?
It's the Bengals.
Okay, it's the Bengals.
It is the Bengals.
Okay, so I'm going to step in and be that guy for a second. One is the Bengals. Two, the people you're talking about are Greeks. They're Greeks. They're not Egyptians. But we can go on from here.
Yeah, but they took what they liked from Egyptian culture, which was that you
like
know,
marrying their sisters.
Yeah, yeah.
This is what they took.
This is what they took.
The foundation of modern Western civilization. They took marrying their sister. Okay.
That's what they went with. I'm just saying. There were lots of Ptolemies. There were plenty of them, and many of them were married to very close blood relations.
Ptolemaias? Sure.
Yeah, there you go. So under that scenario, again, we're talking there about a half-sister, an older half-sister. But what would be the justification? What would be the rationale for that being a desired papal solution? I know the answer to that question, but I'd like to hear you guys answer that to make sure that I'm right.
Yeah. Well, in my opinion, I think that would be a preferred solution because it legitimizes his only male heir. It still keeps Catherine of Aragon's child, Mary, in the mix. And she is related to the Holy Roman Emperor and the current monarchs of Spain. So diplomatically, it makes sense. And at this time, like I said, Anne Boleyn has very much burnt all of her bridges. Even Thomas Cromwell, the Protestant-leaning chief minister, was in favor of Mary becoming queen and saw her as the most likely contender. And the Norfolks, who are kind of like the power brokers of Henry's court at this time, well, Henry Fitzroy is married to the Duke of Norfolk's daughter, but they have not consummated their marriage, which apparently was a command given by Henry VIII because he felt too much sexy times happened and that's what killed Arthur. I don't know. This is just what the reports tell us.
Well, but also I think that happened because I think that was Henry kind of thinking ahead and realizing like, if you don't consummate this thing, it's going to be real easy to get out of it and marry you to somebody else. Like your half-sister, maybe.
Yeah.
If that Henry, has to come to that.
And Henry Fitzroy was besties with many of the Norfolk family. So for them, they would see it as like, well, we like him better than my niece. Anne's kind of a lot. And yeah, the only problem there is how much does anybody know if Henry has tuberculosis?
Or does, I kind of wish we had the other Eric on at this moment. What is the gestation period for tuberculosis? I saw that in our timeline. The guy we're talking about is, I believe
he
beats Anne Boleyn to the other side.
Actually, he does outlive Anne Boleyn by 2 months.
By 2 months, yeah.
So he has revenge.
But if what we're talking about is right, and he is elevated to some sort of royal status, I don't know if it is prince consort or the actual king or whatever, does he still get tuberculosis? How quick does tuberculosis kill?
He would still have tuberculosis at this time. Tuberculosis is unfortunately one of those diseases to where it can manifest rapidly, or there are times when it can be totally asymptomatic and you might not know. If you ever read up about like the Rhode Island vampire scandals in the 1890s, it's a whole weird thing, but that's a topic for another time. Okay.
Well, keep about the fact, too, I mean, we're talking about this happens in January. Mm-hmm. He doesn't die until July. So if everything happens in January, going with this alternate timeline, there's complete probability, and I would say likelihood, that Henry dies in January, and I'm going to speed through it, and then we can go back and kind of parse it out. Henry dies in January. The papal dispensation comes. Henry Fitzroy marries, who is now Mary the First. Basically, it's you're going to sit on the throne as Henry's daughter, but Henry Fitzroy is really going to be the power of the throne. He's going to be king. I think they could get pregnant and have an heir, and we could still have Henry Fitzroy dying in July. I think that's still a reasonable timeline, just because remembering, yes, he does die in July, but we are talking about January. So we do have a little bit of time there, even if he does still have tuberculosis.
Yeah. Well, and there always seems to be that mad rush. You know, this is true around Henry VIII, you know, the desire to make sure there is an heir, you know, so there's this outside pressure, you know, to get things happening and get things done so that
is
you don't
that a
have
lot of waiting.
Yeah. So you don't have a lot of this, you know, this doubt or uncertainty. And again, you've just had the doubt or uncertainty of what's happened here with what's gone on with Henry's death in our alternate timeline. And, you know, the, I think it's interesting to speculate, as you sort of mentioned, Chris, there, what would the titles be and what would the roles be? Because you can imagine a couple of different ways this would play out. The thing that I just wanted to bring up here, just making sure I have this planted firmly in my head and that our listeners have it firmly planted in their head. At this point, at the time of Henry's jousting death here, our point of departure, our fork, England is, quote, unquote, Protestant, in the sense of the path that we've gone down because of the dismissal of the marriage to Catherine, the marriage to Anne Boleyn. But as we were talking again off podcast, which is why it'll be that great thing that we do for our patrons someday so you hear the rest of the episode, right, is that Protestant in name only, probably at best. Remember, Henry had the title Defender of the Faith because he had written pamphlets and other documents in favor of the Catholic position against the more pronounced versions of Protestantism that were there. So even though England has lurched barely down the Protestant path, it's still very early in that arc here, right, guys?
Exactly.
And we all know where Mary's position was on this, not lurching in that direction at all. And so you get the papal dispensation that would permit this Greek/Egyptian wedding. Will that satisfy you, Chris, if I go down that path?
I would even be okay if you called it Hellenistic.
Hellenistic. So that may be what we go with. But there's obviously the benefits that the church would prefer that. The Holy Roman Empire was already mentioned. This aligns well with Spain, which is continuing to rise as a power during this period of time because of wealth coming from the New World and the things that are going on inside of the Catholic and Protestant, which we've talked so often on episodes here about, you know, what's going on the backdrop from here when you flip people from one camp to the other or a country from one camp to the other, how that changes things. England is not too far down my point being going the long way around this. England is not so far down the Protestant path that you can't take a hard stop and go right back, right?
Absolutely. And there's one other thing just to think about. Spain is in personal union with the Holy Roman Empire. Charles V controls the Americas, Spain, and most of Central Europe, a good bit of it. This is like one guy controlling a massive area, and the relationship with him is something I want to come back to.
Okay. So again, this is the point of all that being, which is where I was going to, and you've done a good job of picking it up there. Again, we talked about this before as well. This is not just a, hey, what's going to happen in England kind of question. The rock that gets dropped in the pond there is in England, but it ripples big, right?
Absolutely. Yes.
Just across all of Europe.
Yeah, other than the whole continent.
No. It's bigger than Europe, because we were just talking about a little place about 10 miles south of me right now that is named after somebody in our story right now.
True.
Yes.
Very true.
And actually saw this on a, I was watching a documentary a couple of weeks ago, saw the map of, it was a map of the world showing what portion of the world at that time was under Spanish control or under,
Charles V's personal domain.
The Habsburg Spain, you know, what to call it gets a little tricky there at times, but under that domain, it was big. I mean, you're talking about North and South America, huge portions of that. You're talking about, as you said, the Iberian Peninsula. You're talking about a good portion of Europe, other possessions at a couple of other places, but it's a very substantial part of the populated land mass of the earth at that point that, you know, is in the dominion of Charles or those countries that are affected by that. In the real timeline, eventually we have this little thing called the Armada. Eventually England and Spain are not just enemies, but become pretty pronounced enemies on a number of different fronts. So my first question, I guess, for you guys is Catholic England, assuming that's what it's going to be with Mary and Henry Fitzroy in whatever roles they are, what's the short-term impact? Well, let's start with the short-term, and then what's the longer-term impact?
So the first thing I'm thinking about is what happens during... I'm sorry to do this to you, Alexis, but I'm going to bring this back to Central Europe. What happens during Charles V's reign of the Counter-Reformation and fighting against all of the Lutheran princes, if he is able to get financial support from the Tudors, let's just use people's family names now, because, you know, tying it to geography can get confusing. If there's the Tudors are on the side of the Habsburgs, one, you probably don't have the 80 Years' War in the Netherlands plays out very differently. And it may still be possible. Basically, Charles V is the reason I made the point to talk about him being in charge of both of these huge domains, the Spanish Empire and the Holy Roman Empire, is because he is, I understand, it's the last person to do that. After him, they were still Habsburgs. They were cousins related, but I mean, that's all of Europe at this point. And one of the reasons that led to that split and the decline in power, setting up all of these other things that are to come, is because he broke his power fighting against Protestantism in the Low Countries, the Netherlands, which is right next door to Great Britain. I see Alexis's head going up and down when I mention this, and further on into Germany. So if he's got the economic and the military support of the Tudors in this,
it's a game changer.
Yes. And he may be able to hold that domain we talked about may not be just a fleeting Charles V thing. It may be moving forward the empire.
Right.
Interesting foreshadowing of the other topic we're going to discuss. I'm going to get a Death Star comment. I don't know how it's going to happen, but go on.
Ironically, that episode's coming before this one.
Yeah,
it's really hilarious.
Okay. Go back and listen then. It'll make sense.
It'll make sense. We'll make a reference on the other one so it'll all tie together. That'll be a little Easter egg for our regular listeners. So the other thing that was mentioned there, and Eric, maybe you can talk a little bit about this. is, you know, we've often visited English history on this podcast. We haven't visited, and as a result, we've visited Scottish history. You know, Wales is factored into this. If you talk about England, you're talking about France. If you're talking about the continent, you're talking about Spain. You know, so often you're talking about the other things that are there. We haven't really talked a lot about Ireland, but there's a unique twist in this story that brings Ireland into play. And that's because somebody has another title, right?
That is correct. As Chris said before we got into this, he was quizzing me on it. James, I keep wanting to call him James, but it's Henry Fitzroy. There are so many Henrys. Yeah. Henry Fitzroy was the Lord Lieutenant of Ireland. That is the correct title. Okay, Chris and Alexis have both nodded. Good, good. And there was a scheme to name him an independent King of Ireland at one point, which would be subservient to the King of England. Henry VIII had a lot of weird schemes going on, seemingly all the time, because in the words of David Starkey, the historian who I'm very fond of, he was kind of a butterfly of a man. Like, his interests would just kind of go from place to place. But now with rulers who are firmly Catholic, we have it more in tune with the population of Ireland. What's going to be interesting from a domestic policy angle is how they're going to kind of turn the clock on Henry VIII's half-hearted, arguably, reforms, and how that's going to affect the relationship. Because of that Protestant divide, we see Ireland going on a much different path and constantly struggling for its own sense as a Catholic country, as a nationalist entity against England. And this is kind of where that start begins. So I'm interested to see in what effects this would have. Would there still be a colonization of Ireland by Scots and English?
Well, then there's the whole other thing that comes down from that, you know, the term United Kingdom, you know, it's only because of Alexis's love of this part of history and really having to grasp into it that I understand as well as I think I can understand the distinctions between England and Scotland and what you would call Great Britain and then what you call the United Kingdom. And the United Kingdom actually comes in a couple of different flavors at different points over history when you use that term. But we never use United Kingdom where we're including Ireland into that description. Northern Ireland, yes, that's the current version of that, where we talked about six counties in the northern portion that are, you know, that are aligned as part of the United Kingdom that are Protestant. But I think it's not an unreasonable thing to imagine, again, even if it's not a combination of the kingdoms, but certainly a much closer relationship that exists, where, as you point out, Eric, Ireland and England are not at each other's throats. They're allies in what's going on here. And to me, the other interesting thing becomes, again, further down, eventually we know James the Sixth of Scotland is going to be invited to come and become James the First of England. But, you know, Scotland had much more of a religious, philosophical bend towards Protestantism. James Knox and others eventually down the road to imagining that you may have more of a closer union between England and Ireland, now both Catholic, and Scotland being sort of the odd player out in this thing. Like Catholic Ireland became, Protestant Scotland would have become potentially.
I say you have Irish Scots instead of Scots Irish.
Yeah.
An interesting thing that I will defer to Alexis on this. I do have much more of a surface understanding of what's about to happen in, I'm going to call it Britain, including England, Scotland, and Wales. But generally, in all of these dynastic struggles, the Catholic side is always going over to Ireland and trying to get support out there. That's why you have the settlement of the six counties. I think this may actually reverse, and you have Henry Fitzroy, who already has somewhat of a power base in Ireland, picking up the Catholic standard. And instead of it being the Protestants from Britain going over to support Protestants in Ireland, I think he can use Ireland as a base for Catholicism in struggles, internal struggles in England against whatever surface Protestantism there is. And I agree, it's interesting. I think you would see Protestantism take deeper root in Scotland. But so I think that may be the struggle we're still talking about. You may have a divided Glasgow as opposed to a divided Belfast.
Yeah.
Now, something I would like... Oh, I'm sorry, Alexis. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying... I think Eric, or not Eric, sorry, Chris.
I mean, honestly, I think, it's a pretty safe assumption to call somebody Eric on this show. Yeah.
True. But we're just throwing Roger all over the place tonight.
Or Henry.
Or Henry in this episode. There's plenty
and
of
by the way, around. It's not James Knox, it's John Knox.
Thank you.
see, again, wrong names all over the place. I think it is a pretty safe assumption to pull from Ireland. Henry Fitzroy does have that base. He is Lord Lieutenant of Ireland. So yeah, I do think there is that very distinct possibility that he's going to pull landowners and people of influence from Ireland to deal with kind of that bubbling tension between Protestantism and Catholicism in England, because Protestantism is around in England at this point. There are people who would consider themselves Protestant in England. It's just Henry himself, Henry VIII, prior to his death in this timeline, did not. He was a Protestant on paper. But there were people who did consider themselves Protestant. But with Henry gone and that protection sort of gone, that Protestant air quotes, I think you would see Henry Fitzroy pulling from Ireland to kind of bolster up his Catholicism and get it back on track.
At the risk of chasing a rabbit, but I just saw it run across the path, so it's a woodland creature we have to go after. You know, there's a term that we associate with the Mary that we're talking about here, who's the 19-year-old that's going to, you know, be in this union. We call her Bloody Mary. And that is the result of her assuming the throne after there's been more of a presence for Protestantism and swinging the country back towards Catholicism. You know, when I've studied this period of church history and secular history, you know, Elizabeth comes back as sort of a moderating factor between the two. She finds some middle ground and tries to navigate that through, which is both political and religious in its day. But Mary is a fervent daughter of her mother, Catholic. And to Alexis's
daughter
point,
of Spain that just happened to be born in England.
Yeah, and Alexis's point, there are philosophical Protestant leanings that exist in England. Henry takes advantage of it for the political expediency that it is because of the marriage and the need for, you know, for that marriage, the marriage to Catherine, to be dissolved. But it's not that they don't exist. Do you think we would see potentially under this Mary Henry England, with, you know, the connections to Ireland, do we see tolerance of Protestantism? Do we see it essentially a move towards stamping it out? So you change the balance that happens there. Maybe you bring in, you mentioned those Lutheran German princes, Chris. Now suddenly they feel the need to go and get involved in what's going on, you know, to defend or somehow stand up for those that are being persecuted there. How does this play out with
so earlier those still Lutherans later? Are a little busy closer to home, staying alive.
Okay.
and I think what we talked about with the Irish support and with a hard swing of Mary, I mean, they were able to swing the entire religion of the country Protestant. And we've talked that it hasn't really developed the roots it has. I think Mary can do it, can take Mary. I actually like calling them the Fitzroys because they are both children of the king. And I think this can solve our argument about last names here. I think the Fitzroys can take England Catholic
And they won't have to, it won't get bloody, or it won't get as bloody. They won't be seen as what Mary is eventually seen as, because it hasn't had the opportunity to grow in our timeline.
Okay. Eric, you're going to say something there.
I would say the only way I would see some kind of tolerance, or kind of a, for lack of a better phrase, the don't ask, don't tell policy that you could argue was adopted by Elizabeth. It was just, in my reading, always kind of like a, as long as you say you like me, whatevs. But if we have Thomas Cromwell, the chief minister, who has surprisingly kept good relations with Catherine of Aragon and Mary, he's always the one going up to bat for them of like, yes, they are inconvenient politically, but we should still treat them well. She is still the most likely one to be the heir. Out of practicality, at least, we should be kind to them. I would argue that if he's still around as that chief minister, you could get kind of a policy that you saw under like Cardinal Wolsey of where, yes, there are Protestants, and as long as they aren't too loud about it, they can kind of go about their business. I don't think that would be the official policy written in ink, but I think as long as Cromwell was around and able to keep his head above water, I think we could still see that toleration. I definitely don't think we would see it for higher ranking nobles, but maybe the House of Commons, the occasional one or two Protestant with a few legal bindings on them, probably fine. I'd be really interested to get y'all's take on, so what do you think happens to Elizabeth? Do you think they send her to a nunnery right away? Do you think they try to marry her off? What's y'all's take on that?
We have those, Protestant princesses.
2-year-olds are dying all the time at this time.
Oh, okay, Chris, we got very dark.
Oh, you went dark. Okay, Chris.
I think she becomes like so many of the other. She is something of value. And at this point, she's young enough that we don't know what she would be made into, you know, under this particular scenario that's created here. So, you know, 2-year-old Elizabeth is probably not choosing which side she's on in the question of the Reformation. If she grows up underneath her older half sisters and her
half brother,
yeah, it would be half brother.
I have to stop and do the charting there. The two different half siblings there. Certainly, I could see her, you know, becoming a marriable asset that would go somewhere in some form of unification, wherever that might be down the road, you know, 10, 15 years down the road. Where do you need that to be? I don't know, but something. Alexis is chomping at the bit, so go at it.
Well, I have a question. If Henry's dead, well, couple things. If Henry's dead, does Anne Boleyn miscarry?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I've actually heard them say, because
now we have an Elizabeth that's growing up with her mother, potentially.
Okay.
And Anne Boleyn is believed to have had very Protestant leanings.
Oh, I thought you were going to say a totally different thing there. Yeah. I thought you were going to say had a very close relationship with her brother. And isn't that ironic? I apologize. But
well, I mean that too, but you know.
I think Anne's dead. Anne was not beloved by everybody in the court, certainly by this time. I think she would still miscarry, considering she miscarried 5 days, even with Henry surviving. The fact that he dies is probably, unfortunately, an even greater shock. I kind of take the idea that I think Elizabeth would be kept around, very much to Don's point, as like, we'll keep you in the tool belt. Maybe she could be an heir to Mary if Mary and Henry Fitzroy are unable to produce an offspring. Unfortunately, in our own timeline, Mary had issues with getting pregnant and would later pass away due to uterine cancer. So there is a place for Elizabeth in my mind, but I don't think Anne's going to be there by the end of the year, especially if Mary has something to say.
I think Elizabeth is a very different Elizabeth because she is very much raised in that Catholic tradition, which in our timeline, she is absolutely not. I realize this is something lacking in the audio medium, but you're going to hear everybody's reaction when I say this. I think that Anne Boleyn dies in childbirth with the miscarriage. Yeah, I'm winking.
and the reason that I believe that Elizabeth is still around is that you're always needing to create some form of, you know, alliance through marriage or through something else. And there's a limited number of those pieces that you have that are known to be legitimate. She was still legitimate at this point. And
Henry's not around to reverse that.
Right. And I think it plays to the benefit, you know, we'll use the Fitzroys. There's going to be the Fitzroy dynasty that starts here. It plays to their benefit to have her around, you know. Yes, two-year-olds are dying all the time, but, you know, we can keep her around and we can use her for something. But we mentioned this earlier. It's a very different thing because it's Elizabeth being married, you know, perhaps to, I don't know,
A Habsburg
somewhere, right? There's Habsburgs everywhere. As I mentioned off podcast, you know, somebody's going to end up with a bad chin and before all of this is said and done, because that's the one thing we know is the Habsburg chin.
Can I make a suggestion?
Go ahead.
Wild swing for the end of the park. In Love Actually, the song becomes Habsburgs are all around me, and so my chin will grow. I'm sorry.
I appreciate that, Eric. Because again, it's just, you know, one of the things I love about what we do on A Fork in Time, and, you know, we've been all over the place. We've been all over the place in just this one thing. There's so many things that can change as a result of that small thing that's there. But, you know, I start running down an obscure path of how does this change the English settlement of the New World? Because so much of that is ultimately by separatists from the Church of England. Well, if there's no Church of England, you know, they still may be their Protestant. So they're still, do they go earlier? Do they go in some different way?
Or more specific, I'm thinking about the treaty, I want to say, of Tordesillas, where the Pope gave the New World to the Spanish and basically allowed the Portuguese different areas. If England is still in the realm of Catholicism, is still somewhat recognizing the authority of the Pope. One of the reasons that France, while it stayed Catholic, the French kings did not listen to the Pope. And they were able to settle the New World against that ruling. They were able to just basically say, well, you're not our Pope in whatever manner. If we have a Fitzroy dynasty coming in and participating in the Counter-Reformation, maybe you do have England respecting that ruling by the Pope. And
do we have a three-party Treaty of Tordesillas?
Well, that would have to be a revision of it. It had already been signed, I think. I could be wrong. Or you might have a three-party.
And all that was a treaty that formalized a papal bull that had actually done the division. It moved the line. I think the issue was the Azores there. When they figured out where the line was, they figured out they had a problem with where do you put the Azores. So we've got to negotiate the line a little bit to take care of that.
It actually cuts Brazil. That's why Brazil was allowed to be Portuguese. It nips. That's where it is.
Yeah. And so, you know, but to that point of, you know, so much of this period of history, as we know it in the real timeline, is England standing alone or England standing with various allies against the combined strength of Spain, the papacy, you know, the shifting things that are in, you know, inside of the Reformation and counter-Reformation forces. You put England in the Catholic column consistently, not just for the brief period of time that Mary brought them there and then it flipped back. I mean, that's when I think about 16th century England, I think about the big swings back and forth there that happen between what goes on there. Is, you know, for example, down the road, the Armada is one of the most interesting moments in history to me. I remember reading Garrett Mattingly's the book titled The Armada in my freshman or sophomore year in college in world history and just being fascinated by that story. The amount of money, the amount of resources, the amount of effort that went into creating, when we say Armada, we mean big, we use that as synonymous with being big fleet. We're referring to that, the largest fleets ever built or assembled that we know and what happened there.
Until imagine the Death Star.
Yeah, exactly. See reference for former and future show.
Yeah. Is number two?
Yeah, he's going to get a third one in. He's good. Imagine those resources going to something else because you don't have to devote them to that.
And all of those resources he spent fighting the Lutherans in central Europe, in Germany, now being backed up by the resources. It's not just what he didn't have to spend keeping England. It's what does England bring to the table as a bonus to be able to support the Counter-Reformation?
Yeah,
at this point, you don't have Charles V going off and playing with clocks.
Right.
Because he actually is able to hold on to his power.
Yeah, and where that's fascinating to me, we talked about this also again off podcast, is, you know, at some point in there, is there the line that suddenly produces an English Pope? We talked about that, you know, briefly as something that I think that's not outside of the realm of possibility in the near term for where we're talking about here. Part of that is payoff for, you know, for what's going on. It consolidates the situation, everything that's there. The eventual flow for, you know, everything that happens in so much of what happens further down the road in European history is the result of the seeds that are sown here during the Reformation and the alignments that happen as a result of the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation, the struggles in the New World, the power thing that's there. You know, if you have a more enduring Spain, I know, Chris, you mentioned this as well, you know, and you have England and France who have always been at odds, even when they weren't, you know, but they're always at odds. Mm-hmm. You have a different power structure there. You know, what ultimately happens to France when they're essentially surrounded by strong Catholic powers? Yes, there's what's going on in the sections of what we think of as eventually becoming Germany and in the strongholds of Protestantism, Lutheran strongholds there. But what happens to France under this scenario? It gets impacted in some way, shape, form, or fashion, right?
I think France is not the first nation state in Europe. Its role is vastly diminished. I think we may even talk about Lutheranism the way we talk about the Hussites. That's right. The Hussites were an anti-Catholic-ish kind of an early reform movement.
Well, 150 years essentially ahead of Luther, give or take.
Yep. And it was completely crushed because the rest of Europe got on board with the crushing of it. Yeah. That definitely sounds like what we have right now. As another really, really interesting thing that just crossed my mind, and I know at least two of my co-hosts on this one are really going to light up when I suggest this. Maybe you have the Texification of North America. And here's what I mean. Texas. Hold on.
Okay. Go do it. I am
not in the way you're envisioning it, but if you go back to like the history of Texas, and let me go ahead and throw back to another episode we did on the Tex-Mex combinations. Those were nice ones. Texas, when it started, was nominally under the control of, at this point, the Mexican Empire, Mexican Republic. Some Mexican state entity. To populate it, they let in what were always referred to as Anglo settlers. Why were they referred to as Anglo settlers? Because they were English speaking. In our timeline, Charles V's Spain did not produce the kind of excess population that allowed Britain to settle North America. So in our timeline, maybe you do have a North America that is nominally under the control of some Spanish entity power, but allows in Anglo settlers, because Britain does produce an excess of population, and you might still have a United States speaking English in this scenario.
but getting there in a different way.
Right. Getting there via the Texas path almost.
Well, and you know, any student of American history will, you know, there's the popular sort of American history myth of, you know, the found of the Mayflower experience and religious separatists. And yes, they were coming for the ability to exercise religious freedom in a way here that they weren't allowed to exercise in England. These were the separatists, you know, from the Church of England, which had separated from the Catholic Church. And that influence, you know, if you will, the English common law legal influence, the Protestant, for the most part, there are exceptions to this, but primarily a Protestant religious philosophical bend that's there.
I got to make a plug. The one state that was an exception to that
is Maryland.
Is
Maryland, exactly. but you have that in such a way that I don't think you have the American colonial experience is not obviously the same American colonial experience. And, you know, whether you may have English speaking settlers that are coming over to settle in a much larger, probably more thoroughly controlled Spanish territory in the New World. You know, what that looks like is also a lot of speculation as well. But it's not what we see today. It is the textification in terms of maybe the concept there, but the source of those settlers are not manifest destiny Americans. There's something else that's speaking English at that point. Or in the case of much of Texas, again, going back to what happened during a lot of that, large parts of Central Texas have a strong German influence because there was a very large German immigration that came to Texas. So maybe those non-Spanish speakers that are being invited over come from someplace else. I find it doubtful that they're being invited to come over from Germany, given, you know, what's there. But something different. It's just something different that would happen.
I think they might be strongly German, because if I'm thinking about the populations that, in our scenario, would have people to export. I'm thinking about Britain definitely did. Also, all of what we set up, and we've danced around it a little bit, a little thing called the 30 Years' War that kind of saw to it that there weren't any Germans to export during the time of North American colonization. We stopped that from happening. So you're looking
that doesn't need to happen now.
Yeah, that doesn't. So you've got populations in Europe that are from Habsburg domains, so might be considered friendly. So maybe you have a German-speaking state in some sense emerging in North America, and an English-speaking state, because the English are also kind of in the in this empire. The other thing is there's nowhere near the distinction between English and Irish there is today. The Irish are very welcome over here. That's another population that's going to definitely leave a much bigger mark on the United States in this scenario, or in the North American landmass in this scenario, because, you know, the one thing is, again, I don't see Spain. I see Spain administering North America the way it administered its colonies, which is very light human resources personnel footprint commitment, which is one of the things that happened in the early period of Texas, is you didn't have a lot of people administering it. And when you brought in settlers, it very much changed the character of the area.
Right. And you know, the irony there, how we managed to get from, and I know how we got there, it's a logical path, how we got from Henry not surviving his joust to you know, all things.
Who a German state in North America.
Yeah, we all know all things lead to Texas ultimately, because they should. But it really is, you know, we're talking there about in the real timeline, we're talking about the 1830s. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about events here in the early part of the 16th century. You know, it's easy in my head to sometimes forget that's 300 years. You know, so what we've really talked about here is the fate of what happened in those 2 hours that Eric let us off with, you know, the 2 hours and 5 minutes or whatever period of time was elapsed there. Did those 2 hours really have an impact that, you know, that ripples down 300 years later? I think the answer is yes. What it looks like is unknown, but I think the answer is yes, right?
Absolutely. I have another idea, though, that I want to pitch at you guys. Well, first a sidebar, Suleiman the Magnificent is unable to conquer Belgrade and Rhodes just because if we're assuming there's not the power of Protestantism has been severely lessened, then he's dealing with a much more unified Europe in response. So he probably has to focus more on his Middle Eastern holdings. So maybe he'll be able to successfully conquer Afghanistan. Who knows? But
which the Ptolemies tried. Sorry.
Yeah. Afghanistan is the death of empires. But anywho, let's get on track to, let's assume that France, England, Spain, Portugal is next to Spain.
Yes.
I'm sorry. My brain briefly left me and my soul was outside of my body. Let's assume that they're all able to unify and basically start intermarrying with each other. We already have as politely as I can say, reproductively challenged royal family in England, alongside now even more of the dreaded Habsburgs, to the point to where it's just a very, even more so than it is today, a very deeply inbred system of royal families. Do we see something happening like, say, the 1830s and 40s, to where there were nationalist revolts against their interconnected royal families happening earlier? Because after a while, they're going to start losing the best and brightest when everybody's heart is the size of a grape.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've talked about this, and even in the episode that Alexis and I did, talking about, you know, Victoria's influence, you know, the hemophilia thing, you know, all of that. I could even see a scenario where we just mentioned there, Eric. It's an interesting thing to even ponder. You sort of get to maybe, you know, what we think of as being the World War One period, you know, what leads up in the early part of the 20th century. You could advance that by several generations earlier in a lot of ways. And then depending on what actually happens to France in this reconfigured thing, do you ever reach the point where there's the rise of, again, France sort of being the first nation state per se on the continent? You know, do you ever get to the point where France is what they are? Do you ever get to the point of a Napoleon? Because so much of the 19th century is in response to Napoleon in the first part of the 19th century. I mean, all of these dominoes, the way they start tumbling, you know, get you to a very different point. Now, I know I can never eventually get away from World War One or World War Two, Chris. We've proven that over and over again. But you change when they might happen. Yeah, you know, I hadn't even thought about the impact of removing the 30 years of war as we know it out of the equation and everything that flows from that, because the shadows of, you know, Peace of Westphalia is 1648, if I'm remembering correctly, you know, the shadows of that go for a long way down European history, and lead to so many other things that, you know, that flow off of that, just because of, okay, we're going to end this religious thing finally. You know, we're going to settle this. But that drew the political boundaries of Europe in so many ways. Well, what if those boundaries are different?
Well, yeah. The other thing I'm thinking about is, what if from an economic development perspective, so much of the economic development of Europe is based upon this fracturing which happens right now, happens in the period we're talking about. So thinking about kind of what happens in 1848 or 96, 92, 89, different things happening in different points there. The role of the merchants is very important, and the urban populations in this period is very important. And getting back to kind of the World War One thing, world trade and there being a European market can really change some of these internal things, can really change the fact that all of that gold being brought out of You know, we talked a little bit about it not being spent on certain things, but what is it spent on? And how, what economically happens because of that? Does that lead to kind of an industrial revolution 100, 200 years before? You know, something like that. Because you've got this capital floating around that needs to be put into something, and you can't sink it off the coast of Scotland. I mean, you could, but who's going to do that as an investment plan?
No one.
Well,
you know, there's always Bitcoin.
Supposing we have a unified royal family, like under the Habsburgs, you know, we have the silver mines of Spain coming in, which is going to cause a whole great deal of economic issues in itself, because it'll deflate the value of everything. And we have this unified Europe with a genetic and economic time bomb. The one
at the
thing
top. At the top. But it's at the top. We're still talking about it. Genetically, a very small amount of people. I mean, Europe's going to be okay as a whole.
Exactly. But what do you guys think happens to, like, parliamentary democracy? Because that really, England is one of the few countries that has it at this time. Arguably, some German principalities and low countries are practicing different forms of it, but England is really the only parliamentary system. So,
Polish, you know, Lithuanian Commonwealth. Deep cut, people.
I think it's a good point to raise, Eric, in the sense of what we think of as being modern Western democracy, you know, has its roots in a number of different places across Europe in different ways. But it is fundamentally, more than anything else in my mind, an English thing that eventually gets transplanted to the New World in the form of the English colonies, which become the United States of America. That's not saying it's exclusively that by any stretch of the imagination, but it is, that is such the domination of the timeline that we know, the real timeline of history, that trying to figure out how that develops is different. And, you know, I think there was a reference here, an indirect reference to, you know, Marx and others, you know, do you have more of the types of things that we saw in the French Revolution, ultimately in the Russian Revolution, you know, at some point, do the economics, I think the economics are interesting here, Chris, you brought it up, do the economics change in such a way that you have those upheavals in a different way, at a different time, at a different place, where they ripple in a different way through history? I think the answer possibly is yes. I just have no idea what that looks like or where that looks like.
I'm sorry to step on toes, but Eric, I saw a face. Why don't you go ahead and set up a future episode for us? Because it looked like this is going to be a good one that we're going to want to mine. But we might need to split this one. But what were you thinking, Eric?
My thought. Okay, so I've been listening to the History of Revolutions podcast, and I'm just going through the Russian Revolution, and I'm just thinking, like, oh, Karl Marx's own thoughts about Russia being far too tied to a god emperor might be the same thing here, of like, well, there can be no economic revolution in still a pretty feudal Europe under this. So then I was just thinking, I wonder what Marx would think about at this time.
Or yeah. I'd be more interested in what Max Weber has to think about it, the man that wrote a book called The Protestant Work Ethic.
Oh, that's, I mean, who wrote it. I was trying to remember when you were talking about the economics earlier, of like, who was that guy who said, like, Protestants, we did the economy. Yes.
Well, and then the other thing that goes with that, you know, we've mentioned Marx and Engels, you know, in where? Doing most of that writing in
Britain.
In England. Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, it was, these are Germans, but they're, you know, where are they living and working?
Marx wasn't a German.
Oh.
Engels was Englishman. Marx was some. They kind of had this thing that happened later. They kind of disowned him. He wasn't German.
Well, he had given up his citizenship, yes, but he still count him as a German, kind of.
So, you know, part of the reason I think we end up, and I know we've been all over the literal map here. We've been all over the philosophical map here. We've been all over the other places. But why we so often on this podcast, we've been around this period of English history, is it is so pivotal to the world that we know today. And we've discovered what, half a dozen, probably just in the 140-ish episodes that we've done on A Fork in Time. We've revisited this at least 10, 12, 14 times, probably in different ways, sometimes a little bit earlier, sometimes a little later, sometimes a different way of doing this. But, you know, what eventually becomes Elizabethan England comes to exist because of what's happened with her father before that, you know, what goes on with her, with Mary, her sister, what has happened there influences the timeline that we know in such a way that when you're able to alter that in any fashion, you get these really powerful, again, I use the term ripples, that flow out from it, that can go really wide in the near term, like we've talked about here, or can go really deep in the long term. There's a reason why we keep finding ourselves, particularly an American group of people that are talking about from an American perspective. We try to have an open perspective, but this is our heritage as Americans and how it influences how we got to be where we are. And it's very difficult to imagine it some other way, but it's really easy to imagine lots of places where it could have been something different.
I think this period might just be the founding of English history. This is the point where you start seeing England diverging from a Sicily. It's another island right off the coast, but it has a very distinctive sense of its own identity, and there's multiple sub-identities within it, which we've touched on. But I think this is the point where you start seeing them collectively seeing Europe as an other, as themselves not that well integrated into Europe.
I would totally agree with that statement.
And then the other sort of almost parallel to that, or the other thing to mention there, is, I've mentioned it a couple of times. Again, to me, it's a fascinating event, the Armada. The defiance of England after that event. We withstood the most that one of these continental powers can bring against us, and we're still standing. Elizabeth is defiantly, you know, still on the cliffs of Dover or wherever you want to put her, you know, standing defiantly against the European other you just talked about there, Chris. That carries forward in history in a powerful way. That rolls into with Elizabeth gone, and then with James coming in. So, you know, we move from Tudor to Stuart, but we're talking about Tudor England, and we're talking about Stuart England, and we're talking about England again, not just a subset of, like we've talked about here, a Habsburg Spanish, whatever that is, you know, that blender of that genetic blender that we sort of talked about there that could happen as a result of that. And that becomes a focal point for hundreds of years forward in terms of how history plays out, not only in Europe, but in North America and globally. And, you know, from that point on, England is at risk of being subjugated, or, you know, I guess a couple of other times, but really not until World War II do you really worry that England's going to be subjugated, you know, potentially by a European power. And that, at that point, that's not even really a real threat when you think about it.
I mean, I'm going to throw 1803 in there. I think that is probably a sure period where it might have happened.
Right. But again, we've talked about on our timeline, is there even a rise of Napoleon as we know Napoleon? Right. Because is there a France like we think of France?
Right.
Yeah, big part of that. I'm going to go around for parting shots. We got to find some way to bring this to a close. So anybody, did we miss anything huge or big? I'm sure we did, but anything just burning in your heads right now? Lex, I'm going to start with you.
I think we hit most of the big points. Yeah, to reiterate a point that I call him Dad, so, you know. To reiterate a point he said, I know that we touch on this a lot. I'm actually going to hit on a point that Don and Chris said. Yeah, we touch on this a lot, and I know that people might get, oh, they're going there again. But I think this point in English history is so pivotal. It does have those wide-ranging ripples, and there's so many different ramifications of those things that it's so easy to just go back here. So but I think we've hit some pretty interesting points. We went to places that I didn't even think we were going to go, which was exciting. But yeah, this was a good one. And just, yeah, really enjoyed it. But yeah, I think it's so interesting for me to think about this point in history. And I hope that our listeners don't get tired of going to this point in history, because I think as many times as we've gone to this point in history on the podcast, I think we could go to it just as many more times in the future and not get to all the aspects of it and the different ways we could go forward with it.
And in our defense, we haven't been here in a while.
As we say, I just want to say on a personal note, it's nice to be recording again, because I honestly don't remember the last time I did record. Dad's going to do an episode that kind of goes into, you know, life. Life's kind of been happening. We alluded to the fact I got married, which was a big thing, but then other stuff has just kind of been going on. So it's been really nice to just record again for a couple hours. So, yeah.
Good stuff. Eric, do you have anything that we missed that was big?
The weird thing that keeps popping into my head is that I still think the Enlightenment happens because the Enlightenment was ultimately about how to make better monarchs. I still think that would be something that eventually would happen. However, I just want to read this small passage from Richard II about anybody asking, so why do you guys keep doing England? It's because England, this royal throne of kings, this sceptred isle, this earth of majesty, the seat of Mars, this other Eden, demi-paradise. Okay. I just really wanted to be pretentious with a Shakespeare quote, so I'm sorry.
Yeah, but, so let me start poking some holes in different. That. You're the seed of a Roman god. Yeah, that's unique.
They couldn't talk about Christianity. They had to use something.
It all gets back to the Greeks and the Romans. Like the name of this episode, the seed of Mars, all of this gets back to the Greek and the Romans. But this is the interesting thing, I think, about this is, and this is something I kind of tried intentionally to do in this episode, and apologies, Alexis, is to break that English bubble. And to really think about how this is interacting with what's going on in the continent. And the way we took this, England is much more integrated into the continent. But even in the way it happened, it's interesting to understand how it's playing with the other moving parts going on, not that far away.
Right. Yes, Minister.
Chris, anything else?
That's it.
All right. I'll echo what
the good folks.
I'll echo what Alexis said here. It's been a while since we've had the chance to record, and I've had the chance to record, including her. For those of you that know the history of this podcast, it was the two of us talking about this for a period of time, and then launching off and doing it. And we found good friends along the way who like doing it too. So that's just been the added bonus that's here. So if you've enjoyed four people just sort of ranting and raving on and on about alternate history, you have found the place that you should come back to every week. We're producing an episode every week. We do want to thank our listeners again for their patience. We're recording a couple of episodes. We sort of alluded that here tonight in the recording that we're doing, because we're playing a little bit of catch up. The one that we just recorded will probably release after the one that'll be released before this. So we know what it's going to be. So we're going a little bit out of sequence. And as Alexis mentioned, by this time you will have heard a little bit about why we had the gap in our production schedule. But this is a nice diversion that we enjoy. We hope it's a good diversion for you as our listeners. And we really do appreciate you. So if you want to learn more about the podcast, you can always go and visit www.aforkintypodcast. Our Com, which is our webpage. I had to stop and think what it's called there for a second because I haven't done that in a while. Give us feedback there. There's a place to provide feedback, place to provide topics, suggestions, all the things that go on there. We have a long list of episodes that come as a result of topical suggestions. And we have good folks like Eric and Chris who've come to join the podcast as a result of those suggestions and invited to come along. So if you think we got it wrong, give us some suggestions and come and join us. We welcome you. This is part of the community that we've built. So I won't go on and on. I know it's been a longer episode as we get back into the habit of doing things here and we wandered around a bit, but we appreciate you wandering around with us and hope you found it at least entertaining, if not informative, but we hope you found it a little bit of both. And I like the dramatic flair that Eric brings to the podcast. He is a true thespian who's able to bring that here, and I appreciate that, having touched just by a little bit of drama in my high school days, so I have a great appreciation for it as well. So without any further ado, I'm going to throw it to Lex because this is her chance to do it. We have the suggestion that if somebody happens along a fork in time as a listener, maybe what they should do. Do you have any suggestions about what that might ought to be?
I think they should take it.
I would agree with that. Thanks, guys, for listening.
Thanks for listening to A Fork in Time, the Alternate History Podcast. Learn more and provide feedback by visiting our website at www.aforkintimepodcast.com. Connect to us on Facebook at facebook.com/aforkintime or follow us on Twitter at AFIT Podcast. If you want to support the show financially, visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/aforkintime. We hope you will join us next time.